alcoholic and a drug addict. Hi. So, anyway, thanks to the committee for asking me to come speak. It's always an honor and a pleasure to do something like this. Not that I've done this that much. So, what it was like, huh? It was, when I was 12 years old, I got shipped off to boarding school. Yeah, hi. my father decided it was time for me to become a man, so I got shipped off to school, and I ended up in this boarding school. And there was 250 young boys. Places like Lord of the Flies, right? I mean, they had scoured the earth to find 250 of the most disturbed young people they could find. And I was to find out shortly after getting there that I was the youngest and the smallest kid in the whole school. And I was scared to death, man. I mean, all I can remember feeling was panic. Like something had gone terribly, terribly wrong. I had no idea how this had happened. And I needed to do something about it quickly. Because I had no tools for living. I mean, I didn't know how to deal with the world. I didn't know how to deal with anything, man. I mean, mom, dad, sis, the dog. I could handle that, you know what I mean? But this new world I'd been thrust into at age 12 with this idea in my head that I was supposed to be a man was just beyond me. And I needed some tools for living fast, and I started to get some, you know. In the first week in that school, I met Tiny. Tiny's the, you know, every school's got a guy named Tiny, 6'4", 245, you know. Plays guard on the football team, you know. That I met Tiny, and Tiny, I was walking along with my books under my arm trying not to make eye contact with anybody, right? And Tiny found me and said, "How you doing, punk?" and slapped me in the back of the head. My books went flying, you know, and I had one of those out-of-body experiences that you can have, you know. You know, where I watched myself walk over and hit Tiny, you know. I hit Tiny as hard as I could, which had no effect on Tiny whatsoever. And then I just stood there looking at this guy. It was beyond anything I understood at all. And I just looked at him like, "Well, what do we do now?" You know? That was all I got. That was it. And he looked down at me and said, "You got a lot of guts," and then beat the shit out of me right there. And I remember thinking as I'm taking the beating that this is going pretty well. You know? This is going pretty well. And the reason is that I am absolutely terrified of Tiny. And he has absolutely no idea that that's the case. He just said to me, "You got a lot of guts," right? So, I mean, word spread far and wide, you know, across this campus that the littlest guy in the school had belted the biggest guy in the school. So I was instantly famous, right? For something that, and I had this image now, right? I was this insane little guy, you know, it's like, keep an eye on Hightower, he's liable to do anything, right? And it had absolutely nothing to do with who I am, you know what I mean? I was sitting in my room crying, thinking, you know, should I call my mom now? You know, I was calling my mother every night going, you know, "Please come get me. And this isn't working," you know. And then probably the greatest turning point of my life, I met Matt. Matt walked up to me and he said, "You want to smoke a joint?" I said, "Absolutely." And I didn't even know what he was talking about, you know what I mean? But, somebody was saying to me, "Come with us." And my answer was yes. You know, I got to hook up. I'm out here in the universe by myself, and I need to connect to another human being. He wants to smoke a joint? Fine. He wants to go kill the Spanish teacher? Fine. I'm coming. I'm going with him. And we hooked up with Steve, and me and Matt and Steve went behind the dorm, and Matt lit up the joint and took a hit, handed it to me, and I just did what he did. And Steve had this Tupperware container wrapped in tin foil. And you could tell by the way he was opening it up that what was in there was very important. This is when we get this open, it's all going to change. And he got it open, and it was cheap red wine, man, and in a Tupperware container. And so we got the joint going, a little pull on the wine, and the joint back, and a little more wine, and it happened. It happened, you know? I am bodily different from my fellows, man, and that was the proof of it, that moment. If there is a line we cross, I crossed it right there because the fear went away. All of a sudden, I had this amazing sensation that this could work out. This school thing could work out. Hanging out with these guys could work out. I had this sense of it's going to be all right. And I don't remember ever feeling that before. It was an incredible moment for me. And I thought, I don't know if it's the wine or the pot or these guys, but I'm doing this as often as I possibly can. And so from the very beginning, I was drinking, I mean, it's humble beginnings, a little cheap red wine. I mean, there wasn't a grape within 1,000 miles of where they made that wine, right? I mean, this was cheap red wine. And that pot, I mean, it was just very humble beginnings. But the point is that the very first time I drank to deal with how I was feeling. It wasn't a social lubricant for me. It was the fear killer. This was the stuff that could kill the fear that was running my life. And I was going to do, I mean, my commitment to that was profound from the very beginning. And I thought, I'll do this as often as possible. And I did every day for the next 16 years, right? I mean, my 13, I was into pills. I found Tylenol, Placidil, Seconal. You know, my first love affair was 3-grain pharmaceutical Tylenols. You know? I mean, what problems? I don't have any problems. I can't remember ever having any problems. The 14 was psychedelics. I got into psychedelics. The first time I took acid, I took 3 hits of white lightning and went to the supermarket. I was 14 years old, you know, and I was just blazing. And I remember, supermarkets are difficult for me to this day. And there's something about the lighting and those rows and... It's a very disturbed feeling. Particularly, have you ever been in one of these markets, these Gelson markets? Those places are frightening, man, because they're perfect. It's the only place in the world where everything is perfect. You go in, you take a can of corn off of the aisle, and a little guy in a uniform runs up and puts another one back. It's a real scary place. Anyway, so 14 was psychedelic. I did about 650 acid trips. Got reclassified legally insane by the military a few years later, but that's another story. I think there's a correlation between those two. 15, I started shooting dope. I peaked. That was the peak of my adolescence when I was 15. I started shooting dope. I spent 3 months on a boat in Marina Del Rey like this. You know what I mean? Those little fold-down tables on the boats, you know what I mean? Where you just put their, you know, that formica, you know, it's nice and cool, you know, you put your head on them. Your head comes up, you take another shot, you go back down on the table. I had 3 months I spent on this boat shooting Demerol, and it was the best party I ever went to in my life, man. I didn't talk to anybody, I didn't feel a thing, I didn't have one feeling for 3 months, just out. And I was partying. I mean, that was the best party I could remember being to. It was perfect. Perfect. I didn't feel a thing. And, I mean, I talk a lot about the drugs. The cocaine kicked in about 15. Always for me, though, the bottle was there. Alcohol was the great equalizer for me. Because I never knew how good that cocaine had been. I never knew if I had enough heroin to get through the night. I didn't know if that acid was going to be just a little too good. You know what I mean? You get a little too far out there. I always knew what that quart of Jack Daniels or that fifth of gin was going to do. I could rely on the punch in that bottle. And it was the equalizer for me. I could either, you know, a little too much cocaine, you can't get your mouth open anymore, you know. I'm in the right place, man. You know, a little too much cocaine, and you suck a little gin through your teeth, man. Things will loosen back up, you know. You know, not enough heroin, man. Jack will get you the rest of the way. To that cool, dark place. I mean, and the point is, it's not about drinking to feel better for me. It's about drinking to feel nothing. Nothing is what I have to shoot for. It's what I've always had to shoot for. And the reason is, I'm aiming at the fear. I'm trying to kill the fear. I'm trying to get that hole in my gut to be quiet. Wind's whipping through there. It's making a lot of noise. It's making me uncomfortable all the time. I got to ease the pain. I got to get that fear off of me. And that's why I drink and use, to get at that. I mean, if I've got this barrel of emotions going on inside me, swimming around on the surface is just, you know, the basic everyday stuff. You know, lust, confusion, you know, happiness, depression. I'd be feeling any 3 or 4 of these at any given moment, you know. But down in the bottom, man, that strong undercurrent that's running my life is fear. And that's the thing I'm using at. I can drink and use through confusion like that, man. But I got to get at that fear. I'm at killing the fear. And it's always, for some reason, with me, the last thing to go. You know, it's the last thing that that's able to quiet down inside me. And as a result, I've been a blackout drinker from the beginning. I was all right with blackouts. You know? I mean, you know, you wake up the next morning, you have no idea what you've done. You're not in jail, and you're not in the nut house. It went all right. You know? I was acceptable. And the reason is that that was the level of my commitment. I mean, you know, people out there talk about how, you know, we're unable to make commitments in here. I think that's a lot of bullshit. I mean, I was committed to drinking and using no matter what. That was how I drank and used, no matter what. And in the beginning, that was cool. I mean, in the beginning, what price did I pay? Wake up with a little headache, you know what I mean? Well, you know, so, you know, a couple of friends are irritated with you, you know, because you threw up in their car, you know, or on them. And they're a little pissed off at you, you know what I mean? But you get back to using again, and everybody forgets about it and moves on to the next high. It's no big deal. So the price was very small, and the reward that I got from using in the beginning was profound, man. I mean, to find something in my life that would kill that fear, whew, what a gift. You know, I am grateful to this day for drugs and alcohol. I mean, they saved my sanity. And I'm very grateful to the program because it saved my life. Anyway, 15, 16, I dropped out of high school. I decided I'd had enough of that. My father came back in my life, said, "You're obviously out of your mind." Had me committed to my first mental institution. They locked me up my first nut house for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation. And I was thinking, one more time, something just wasn't right. I mean, being in the boarding school, I mean, something was wrong. I didn't belong there. I felt that way at home, you know, and then I felt that way in the boarding school. Then I felt that way in the nut house, you know what I mean? I'm walking around in this nut house, and I'm thinking, I'm just a little confused, you know? There's people in this place that have made a conscious decision to go nuts, you know? And there's some very nutty people in this place. And it was 3 cups of pills a day and a shot, you know? And like all you did all day long, and you got the shot if you acted out real bad, you know? And everybody got the 3 cups of pills, and only the really disturbed guys got a shot. So all you did every day was sit around and think about a new way to get a shot, you know? Yeah. You get your shot every day. And I learned about, and tools for living at that point in my life. I mean, I was a high school dropout, a drug addict, and an alcoholic. So I had drugs, alcohol, violence, and soon to develop run. I mean, these were my tools for living that I was developing. And I'm in the nut house, and I didn't know they had the Thorazine cooking in those cups of pills. You know, your brain's working fine, you know what I mean? And I'm sitting in the cafeteria one day with those. They got them here, man. I love it when they have those green exit signs that are lit up like that. I love those signs. I mean, when you're in the nut house and they've got you locked down, you're looking at those signs and you're thinking, that's it. That's it in one word, man. That's all I want to do is just exit. I just want to exit. And I made my break one day. I was sitting in the cafeteria looking at the sign. I thought, this is it. I'm going. I'm ready. Here we go. Go! And I was hauling ass, man. You know, and then you hear those demoralizing words from the nurse's station, Ed, when you got a minute you want to grab early, he's making a break for the door. You know what I mean? The whole point of that is this. I mean, if you're like I thought of myself as a pretty sane guy at the time, all right? And a pretty sane individual would realize at that moment that this is pointless and you need to just shuffle back to your chair, you know what I mean? And finish your Jell-O. I am defiant to the end, man. And as I'm shuffling towards the door, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, now, fuck you, Ed. You know what I mean? If you want me, you're going to have to come get me. I am not sitting down. You know, so I worked as hard as I could till Ed came and took me back to my room, you know, with no doorknob. And I talked my way eventually out of that place. I've since come, you know, that was a lot of years ago, and I've since done business with that organization. And it was real nice, man, sitting in an office with this guy who's the CEO of this company. And he'd been there a lot of years, and he kept saying, "Your name's really familiar. Your name's really familiar." Saying, yeah, it's a common name, you know. Anyway, so I got out of there, and I wandered around on the street some more, and I got they threw the net over me one more time. And I mean, if you're going to live my life, it's important to know what's up in the nut house. If you're going to get tools for living again, another tool for living. If you're going to get thrown in the nut house, and you want to escape, you got to get out before they get the medication in you. Because the medication gets you in and gets to working. Your tail is salted, man. You're staying right there. So the next time they caught me, you know, I just did what we, you know, people like us do. I sat down in the room and I got my mother sitting there, you know, looking real upset. And I get the psychiatrist, you know, making lots of notes. And the nurse is on the way down the hall to take me to my room again. And I just said, you know, God, I'm really glad you got me. You know, it was really, really terrible out there. Glad to be back in here. Glad to be getting some help. Hey, look at that. Hauled ass, man. I ran. And as I'm running for that fence with that intern on my tail, I'm like about 16 and a half, 17 years old. I'm a high school dropout, a drug addict, an alcoholic, and at any moment, hopefully, an escaped mental patient, you know? And that's the sum total. That's my resume right there, you know? That's my life has amounted to, and all I'm thinking is that if I make that fence, I don't have a problem. If I can make that fence, I don't have any problems, because I'll be loaded in 20 minutes. This is my town, and that's all that matters. My commitment was to drink and use no matter what, and I honored that commitment right up to the end. Hit the streets, did 3 years out on the streets through a series of real strange circumstances that only people like us can create. I ended up in a prestigious business college in Northern California. Yeah, so how that happened, I'll never know. I'm up there, I'm living with this woman that I'd met at a party. We talked for 20 minutes, it went pretty well, so we were in love. You know, I got accepted to go to this college, you know, and we piled all our belongings and 8 pounds of hash in the back of this truck and drove to Northern California to higher learning, you know. And she got a straight job, and I was going to college, and I was dealing drugs on campus, and I was going to marketing classes and production classes and distribution classes, and I was applying these to my business, you know. And business was booming, and I thought this was a great school to go to. And everything looked fine, you know. And when I was 21, I got diagnosed to have malignant cancer. And flew back to L.A. and did the nuclear medicine thing and the major surgery and did all that stuff that you do when you get that disease, you know, way back then. And they told me, you know, you could die. And they got my family prepared for me to die. And all I remember feeling at the time was, you have no idea who you're talking to. You know, I could die. You know, I faced that problem maybe 2 nights a week. You know what I mean? Yeah? This shot could kill you, Earl. Yeah, it probably could. Bang! How many reds have you taken? I have no idea, but there's 3 more on the table, and I know for a fact I wouldn't put out more than was required for the evening. I mean, and that's an interesting thing about people like us. You know what I'm saying? A guy alluded to it that I heard speak yesterday. I mean, when did you ever say, no, no, thank you, I've had enough? No way. You know, you hit the floor, and somebody else says, I think he's had enough. So anyway, so I did the cancer thing, and it didn't kill me, and it never really even occurred to me that it would. And I ended up back in college, and I'm going to college again. And by the time I'm at this point, a junior in college, I've got an early acceptance to go to USC Law School. You know, the college thing's cooking. I'm going to law school. I'm editor-in-chief of my college newspaper. The woman is long gone. I mean, this was not working. I mean, I was incapable of a relationship. At all. I was incapable of having friends. I was incapable of any kind of loving and being loved in my life. I wasn't really any good at that stuff because I knew that what my father told me when I was a very young boy was true, that I was no good and I was never going to be any good. And that I was a liar and a thief and a drug addict, and I'm the kind of guy that occasionally they have to lock up, you know, and get a grip on before they let him back out in the world again. And I knew that I was never going to amount to anything. And all this stuff I had going on the outside was just stuff to keep you far enough away from me so that I could drink and use the way that I wanted to. I wasn't going to law school because I wanted to be a lawyer. I was going to law school because my father was an attorney, and he had thrown me away. And I was going to go to law school and become an attorney independent of him so that I would be his equal and he would have to love me and he would have to take me back. My life was built around fear, resentment, things like that. I mean, it was what was fueling my life. I had no interest in the law. I had no interest in school. I had no interest in anything other than, did you have sex for me? Did you have drugs for me? Did you have money for me? Did you have influence for me to be able to get any of the above? If so, I was interested in having a conversation with you. If not, next. I mean, my whole life was based on self-centered fear. My whole life was based on self-centered fear and getting from you. I mean, I'm afraid of those two things. Afraid I'm going to lose something I've got, you know, or fear that I'm not going to get something that I want. Fear just drove everything. And as a result, I was so self-centered and so self-contained that I was really incapable of connecting with another human being. And that was incredibly apparent in my life. And as a result of that, I had to use more and more and drink more and more and more to mask what was becoming very obvious in my life. When I was 21, my mother, right before my 22nd birthday, my mother called me from L.A. crying, saying, "We haven't been anywhere as a family in 10 years. Let's just go somewhere as a family." And I said, you know, So I flew back to L.A., and it was one of those, spent the evening at a friend of mine's house down in L.A., and it was one of those, you know, driving back to the house where you can't get your mouth open again, you know. Showed up at the house at 6 o'clock on November 7th, 1974, which was my birthday, natal birthday. And we got in my father's plane to fly to Guadalajara to celebrate this birthday, and on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother, my father, and my little sister were all killed, and I was not. And I woke up on this mountain in Mexico, and I had a fractured skull, and my back was broken in three places, and I was paralyzed from the waist down. And I had a crushed leg and a crushed arm and massive internal injuries, and I was conscious. And I thought that was the cruelest joke of them all, that I was awake, you know. And I laid there, and they were all laying in front of me, and there was nothing I could do except watch them all bleed to death. So I did. And I quit. That was a point in me where I very clearly, very calmly quit. All of this energy that I had put into my life of keeping, you know, some kind of a front up, keeping you away from me, you know, going to college, you know what I mean, doing the thing, you know, being even remotely socially acceptable. I mean, all of those things went out the window. I swore on that day that I would never love another human being again as long as I lived, and there is absolutely no way I would ever, ever tell you who I am. There's no way you're going to be able to love me. I'm not interested in this loving and being loved. I'm not interested in being in the world. I've never been any good at it anyway. It's not like I was forced at that point in my life to give up something that I held dear. I didn't. It was almost like a relief. It's like I have no reason left to pretend. And I stopped right there. I was one, and they took me off the mountain of I don't know how long I was up there, but they took me down off the mountain, and they took me to the Red Cross station, and they tagged my right toe and waited for me to die. And I didn't. And I was very vocal about that. And I just kept yelling and screaming. They finally took me to the hospital, and they plastered me from the neck down. I was just this big cast, right? And they shipped me back to the States after interrogating me for a long time. I had federales in my room and interpreters and guys with guns. It was a real interesting experience. They flew me back out of there, and I landed up in the States and went into a hospital, and they told me that I may not walk again, that I'd have a withered left hand for sure, and that I'd be blind in my left eye. No, that's true either. I was crazy. I came out of that hospital as strung out as I've ever been in my life, because when you're a dope fiend like me, and you got all this real high drama working in your life, man, you can work those nurses. You know? And it got cold-blooded, man. I mean, I worked it. Yeah, my family's dead. Can I have a shot, please? You know? You know? I worked it. And I came out of there. I've had the crazy leg ever since, man. You know what I mean? That trying to get to sleep, you know, and I just said, oh, man, my nerves in my legs just never made it back. And I got out of the hospital and went on what was to be my last drunk. And it lasted for 4.5 years. And I was drunk and loaded on a day from the moment I would come to till I would pass out. Now, that could be 3 hours or that could be 3 days. Had absolutely no clue what was going to happen. Every time my lips kissed that pipe or took another drink, right, or had another shot or did whatever was up that day, it was up for grabs. It was just up for grabs what was going to happen. Blackouts were the normal fare, and it got real, real nasty. Real nasty. And the worst stories can go on and on and on. What happened was that I came out of that last blackout, and I knew all the ambulance drivers and the emergency rooms and the police, and the Bel Air Patrol wanted to kill me. Those guys didn't like me at all. Neighbors thought I was with Manson. I was not. The only disclaimer I'll make. And I ended up drinking my way into nothing, man. I had no friends, no family. It was all gone. I drank and used until it was all gone. In the end, for me, my drug of choice was alcohol, and I used cocaine to keep me on my feet so that I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And when I get sick, I couldn't drink anymore. I'd eat Valium until I could get well enough to go back to drinking. That was it. That was my cycle. And that was what I did for 4.5 years, and when it was all over, I was 215 pounds, I was yellow, and I was dying of the disease. I was dying, and I felt it. You know what I mean? I mean, they told me I was going to die before, and it had never occurred to me that I would. But when I came out of that last blackout, man, I knew that it was true. I knew that the party was over. And I had what they call a moment of clarity in here, and mine was this, that the bottom for a guy like me is dead, right? What I hit was an emotional and a spiritual bottom. I mean, I had known for a long time in my life that I wasn't connected to another human being on the face of the earth. And that was the direct result of my actions. That I was responsible for that, and I was okay with it. But when I came out of that last blackout, I had the experience. See, I'm from here. I live down in here in my experiences. What I understand is of little value to me. It's where I live from down in here. And I'd known in my head I was alone, but I woke up that morning and I felt it. I felt completely and totally alone in the world, and I was so beaten up and so torn apart that there was nothing left to fight back with. I couldn't get one more drink to my lips, man. And I gave up. I gave up. And this friend of mine took me to an emergency room. They pumped my stomach, and they said, get him out of here. He's going to die. And they took me over to another hospital. They kept me for 3 days. I got worse. They took me by ambulance down to another hospital down in Long Beach, and they kept me for another 42 days. And I came out of there as crazy as I've ever been in my life. I had no place to live. I had a car nobody else could get into. I had no money. I had a few clothes, and I was insane. And through another strange series of circumstances, I mean, to me, anything that appears to me to be odd or strange is a God shot. You know, just through this strange web that was woven, I ended up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was no CA then. And I sat in the back with my arms folded, you know, with my best get away from me look on my face. You know, I was just looking as tough as I could possibly look, which is pretty hysterical because I'm not a tough guy, right? Or a bad guy. I never have been. And I sat in the back with my best, you know, what do you want? And this guy walked up to me and he said, hi, I'm Vegas. I'm an alcoholic. And I said, so what? You know, what are we bragging here? You know what I mean? Not exactly the high point of my life, buddy. And he just looked at me and smiled, and he said, keep coming back. And that was like a knife through me. Because you don't realize how long it's been since somebody said something to you until you hear it, and it's been a long, long time. And he said, keep coming back. And nobody said that to me for a very long time. And I thought, and he smiled at me. You know, I gave him my best tough guy, and he just smiled at me. I thought, man, I'm here 15 seconds, and my cover's blown. You know what I mean? These people already know. They know I'm like glass. You know what I mean? They know that if you come, I'm not worried that, you know, I don't say stay away from me because you're going to get hurt. I say stay away from me because I'm liable to get hurt. I'm like glass over here. If you just walk up and say, what, you ask me a question like, what's happening? How you doing? You know, what's going on? I don't know the answers to any of these questions. You know, and you're going to walk up and ask me these things, and I'm just going to shatter. Oh, God, what a miserable time of life that was, man, being new. So, those of you that are new, God bless you. You know? I mean, you may not realize it, but he already has. You know? If you're new in here, man, you've already been blessed. If you're in here at all, you've been blessed. So anyway, it began, you know, the recovery process began for me. And I mean, and I was wandering around in here, and I mean, I love being a crazy newcomer and thinking, my thing was, okay, you know, I mean, I'm like an old thief, dope fiend, you know, lion snake, you know. My thing is, I'll sit in the back, I won't talk to anybody, I'll find out how to work this deal, and I'll work it, you know, because I'm still in charge. I don't know anything about steps or God or any of the things that are going on in these rooms. I mean, I don't have any experience with it. And I sat in the back, and they started talking, you know, keep coming back one day at a time. Just don't drink or use no matter what. I hate that one. I hate that one. I drink or use no matter what. You know what I mean? If it was just don't drink or use no matter what, why the hell would I come here? Why would I do this? Why would I sponsor all the guys that I sponsor? Why would I listen to the shit my sponsor tells me to do that I don't want to do? Why would I do any of this stuff? I'd just go out there and not drink or use no matter what. Fact of the matter is, man, I've learned about the nature of this disease. No way I can do that. No way. So I don't like that one, so forget I even said it. You know what I mean? All these slogans were coming at me, and all these, like, what seemed to me to be trite little ideas were coming at me, and I'm grabbing these things, and I have no idea what any of this means. There's no rhyme or reason to any of this shit. Every meeting seems different. Everybody's got something different to say. I don't know what's going on. I'm just grabbing this shit and stuffing it in my pockets and thinking, I'll figure this out later. I don't know. You know? We'll talk about this later. I don't know what any of this shit means. And I'm talking to this woman. Naturally, I spoke to no man when I got here. And I was talking to this woman, and she said, you know, you need a sponsor. And I said, great, what's a sponsor? She said, that's somebody who's got what you want. Great, you know, another AA trick question, you know. All right, what do I want? I don't know. How am I supposed to know? I mean, that's a pretty funny question to ask a new guy, you know. Somebody who's got what you want. I want to get high. So I go looking around for a sponsor, right, and I come across this guy. Actually, this is the real story about how I found my sponsor. This is supposed to be a spiritual meeting. Not that I think anybody is qualified to speak at a spiritual meeting, I mean. But the way I found my sponsor was that there's a lot of stuff that went on in my life that I don't talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do not talk about from the podium. But as a result of some of that stuff, there was this movie studio that wanted to make a movie of my life. And I went to this business meeting, and there was this producer there and this set designer, and these other people were there. And I was going along talking about my life and going to the bathroom every, 90 seconds. You know, kind of talking as I was walking back and forth across the room. And there was a guy in that room who had been working with these people for over 6 years. And he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was anonymous. And none of them knew that he was a member of AA. None of them knew it. And he broke his anonymity that night in that room in front of all of those people, all of those business associates, to let me know that there was a program and that if I didn't get to it, I was going to die. And I thought that was a little dramatic, you know? But a very nice gesture, you know? So I forgot about this guy and this deal, and I wandered off. And a year and a half later, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, wandering around looking for a sponsor. And this woman says to me, have you ever heard of this guy, Donald M.? And that was the guy. And I thought, I got this cool kind of a chill over me, and I thought, wow. And I went back to my house and went to my phone book. And I mean, people give you business cards, you know, hundreds of them, and you lose them, you know, and you write your number on the back of them and give them to somebody else, and, you know. Right? And I went to M in my book, and there was one business card clipped in there, and it was his. It was the only one I had. And I called his number, and he answered the phone. And I said, hi, Donald, my name is Earl Hightower. I don't know if you remember me. And he said, yes, Earl, I remember you. And I said, I'd like to come talk to you. And he said, be at my house tomorrow at noon. I went to his house, and I asked him to sponsor me. And that man is a God shot, because that man has been my sponsor for almost 11 years now. And I have learned from having him as my sponsor things that are unavailable to people like me. He said to me, you don't have to like what I tell you, and you don't have to think it's a good idea. You just have to do it. And I can work there. I could do that, you know. I saw that there was room to dance in there somewhere, you know what I mean? I'll be able to work as Earl sees it in there somehow, you know. So we went to this meeting. Little did I know who I was dealing with here. I mean, this man had more passion and more focus and more clarity than any other human being I had ever met in my life. He was out of his mind, and he was just so good at being Donald. He was so good at living his life. And he was so passionate about this thing, recovery, that I just thought, I want that, man. That's what I want. I want to feel strongly about something again. I haven't felt strongly about anything. There's just this little light flickering away inside me, and I'm not in the world at all. I don't have any caring in me. I don't know how to do any of these other things. I want what that man has. And he said, if you want what I've got, you got to do what I did to get it, man. And he took me to a meeting, and they said, they make 550 cups of coffee here every Friday night, and you're going to make them for the next year. I said, fuck you. And then he said to me, fine, drink. I thought, Jesus, man, they just go right to the bottom line on you around here, you know? So So, you know, I said, all right, I'll make the goddamn coffee, right? But thinking to myself as I'm doing this, you obviously don't understand the nature of my problem, Donald, you know? I'm going crazy over here. I wake up in the morning. My goal for the day is to get tired enough to go back to sleep. The only escape left, you know what I mean? I could kill somebody or myself at any moment. I'm really not having a good time here. I'm crazy. And you say to me, make a little coffee. I don't think you get it, right? And the fact of the matter is, he gave me one of the greatest gifts anybody's ever given me that day, ever, in my life. And I just couldn't see the forest for the trees, man. I mean, he could have sat me down and said, Earl, listen, man. What I'm going to do for you is I'm going to explain to you the principle of service. And what you're going to do is every Friday night, you're going to go open up the room, you're going to help them set up, you're going to fill up the coffee pots, you're going to make the coffee, you're going to make sure not to blow the circuit, you're going to get the coffee out, everything's going to be right, you're going to go to the little meeting before the meeting, you're going to be there for the meeting, you're going to make sure everything's right, you're going to clean up afterwards, you're going to put the coffee pots away, you're going to turn out the lights and lock up the room and go home. It's going to take you about 4.5 hours every Friday night, right? And you're going to feel so much better at the end of that 4.5 hours because we will have gotten you out of your self-centered madness. For 4.5 hours, you will be thinking of others, be accountable to and responsible to other people for 4.5 hours. We're going to get you out of self. We're going to show you the magic of being there for another human being, considering someone else. And we know for a fact, Earl, that you've never done this before in your life. It's going to be a totally new experience for you. He could have told me all that, and it all would have been true. I wouldn't have understood a word of it. A word of it. So he just said, make the coffee or drink. So I made the coffee. And 6 months into that commitment, I was feeling pretty good on Friday nights and had no idea why. But well into sobriety, 2 years into sobriety, it started getting better for me. Things started getting better. I was going to 7 to 9 meetings a week. I was picking up newcomers and taking them to meetings. I had commitments in meetings. I was talking to my sponsor on a daily basis. I was doing all this stuff and things started to get a little bit better for me. I got the 5 years of sobriety, and I started to line my ducks up again out in here, man. My job had turned into a career. I had a nice place to live. I had a good car. Some money in the bank. I knew the bills were going to get paid. I was speaking in AA. I was taking out panels. I was sponsoring guys. I was doing all this stuff that's impossible for a guy like me to do. I can't do this. I can't get up here and tell you the truth about who I am. I can't tell you that I'm afraid of you. You used to be afraid of you. I can't tell you that was the truth for most of my life. I can't tell you all that stuff because you're going to find out who I am and you're going to throw me away like my father did, and I don't play that game anymore. And I adhered to that promise I made on that mountain in Mexico, never to love another human being again as long as I live, well into recovery, man. I was in here dancing with you, smiling with you, yeah, fine, getting to know you, yeah, we're friends. I was sleeping with some of you. And, man, it was a plexiglass wall up between us. Nobody was getting in. I lived alone. I lived in an apartment. I lived in this one apartment for 6.5 years of my recovery. And there were probably 3 or 4 people that saw that place. I would do all my stuff out here and I would go home to my isolation and I would stay there because I was holding true to that promise. I wasn't going to love and be loved. I had gotten very good in here at doing that dance, but I wasn't really playing. I got the 6.5 years of sobriety and I was going nuts. And I went up to this old-timer, man. You know those guys with the light beams coming out of their eyes, you know? If you're new, man, watch it. Those people will mess you up. Because they get it real simple, you know what I mean? They get it real simple. And, it's hard for people like us when we're not under the influence to avoid undeniable truth. You know? And they will just turn around and just bang, hit you with a little, and your life's different now, you know? It's what I call the bitch of enlightenment, you know? Once you know better, you're stuck with it, you know? There's no getting rid of it. You know better now. I walked up to this old timer and I just said, look, my life is a mess. I got 7 to 9 meetings a week, call my sponsor every day, blah, 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 you know, commitments, going, you know, the whole 9 yards, speaking, sponsoring, all of this stuff, man. I'm Mr. AA. What's the deal here? And he just looked at me and he just said, well, Earl, I saw you come in, pal, and if you don't get a program, you're going to go out and you're going to drink and you're going to die. I said, excuse me, didn't you hear anything I just said? I got a smoking program here, and you're talking about I don't have any program. What else could I possibly be doing? And he said to me, you need to get the big book. I said, I got a big book. He says, have you read it? Yeah. What it was like, right? Something like that? What it was like? There's a chapter in there. I had a friend of mine one day. It was the best thing I ever heard in my life. I said to this friend of mine, have you been reading the big book? She says, yeah. So what have you read? She says, well, I just finished that chapter. We antagonists? Oh, what are you going to do? I just said, keep reading, honey. Keep reading. So anyway, God. So I said, all right. I went and got this buddy of mine. He had like 8 years at the time. I had 6.5 years at the time. I went and got the book and said, okay, we're new. You know, this time deal is an illusion, man. And the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And we're new. Just give it up, man, and start from the beginning. We got this big book, and we started to find the step Nazis, man. We found the people, the book thumpers, the zealots. You know what I mean? All those guys that I've harbored deep-seated resentment for my entire sobriety. You know what I mean? I hate those guys, right? I didn't like the guy I went up and asked the question of, you know, but I went up and I asked him, what should I be doing? Because I respected what he was having in his life. I didn't particularly like the guy. I don't particularly like him now. But I had tremendous respect for how he lived his life. Who he was real comfortable with was him. It wasn't necessary for me to be comfortable with him. It was necessary for him to be comfortable with him. And what he was saying to me was, you got to get right with Earl, man, and you're not. And it was the truth. So we went and we got the book and we sat down with the book and we started right on the cover. You know, that symbol that we wear around our necks and everybody runs around with, on the, you know, and it's right on the cover. It's an ancient spiritual symbol that stands for mind, body, and spirit brought together as a whole human being. Or a Hudson Hornet hubcap. Is there? As a friend, lest we get too carried away with ourselves, you know what I mean? I was talking to this guy earlier, a couple of my buddies sitting over there said, you know what really happened, man, was Bill Wilson was passed out in the gutter, man, and he came to and he looked up and there was the hubcap of a Hudson Hornet, man. The circle with a triangle in it. Keith and Danny right over there, man. Spreading the word. But AA adopted that symbol, and instead of mind, body, and spirit brought together as the whole human being, and that was the balance I had to seek as a human being, AA adopted that symbol, and it was unity, recovery, and service. It's the same thing. The unity is the body. I got to bring my sober body in here, and I got to sit it down with my people. This is the body. Look at the body of this thing, man. This is what it's about. This is the body of recovery. This is where I got to bring my ass and sit it down. Because I can go around out there like a homicidal maniac and walk into a room with it all over me and sit down, and somebody from outside says to me, how you doing? Or I say, I'm all right. And they'll believe it. I come in here with that stuff all over me and sit down and say, you say, how you doing, Earl? And I say, I'm okay. You just say, uh-huh. Take a seat, man. You want to read chapter 5 tonight? You know what I mean? You guys just start reeling me in because you know who I am. I got to be with my people. These are my people. I've got to bring my ass in here and sit down, shut up, and listen. And that's what I did for a long, long time. Still do it. Still crave those times to do that. The recoveries of the mind. I mean, if this is the problem, man, if the drink is the problem, if the cocaine is the problem, if this is the problem, and I go put stuff over here, man, and I sit that down and that's it, then I don't have a problem anymore, right? Well, if that were true, man, detox centers would be kicking out winners, man. 72 hours and free. I wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. But I got this. I'm mentally and physically different, bodily and mentally different from my fellows. Bodily, I sober up, I bring the sober body, and I sit it down in here, first side of the triangle, the unity. Got to come in here. Got to have this. Got to have this support, or I'll isolate, and I'll get back to my best thinking, and my best thinking will kill me. The recovery is of the mind. What I need to realize is that stopping ain't my problem. I need to learn how to not start again. That's the deal for me. So that means I've got to be relieved of this obsessive thinking, and that the persistence of this illusion that I can drink like the normal individual is astonishing. Many of us pursue it to the gates of I have been to those gates. I've been locked up. I've hit the ground hard. You know what I mean? I've had my toe tagged. I've been to the gates of insanity. They're big gates. Very big gates. I don't want to go there anymore. I don't like those. You know, I don't want that anymore. And if I don't want that, then there needs to be the recovery of the mind. The recovery of the mind is the whole point of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned. And that those steps are my recovery program. That's the recovery program that I never had, the program I needed that was absent in my life. And I went about the business of those steps. So it's the second side of the triangle. It's the recoveries of the mind, and it's the 164 pages of the big book. Step one is, what's the problem? If I don't know what the problem is, I can't very well come up with a solution that's going to make it happen. Right? And the problem is I'm powerless. Lack of power is my dilemma. That's what's cooking in my life. That's what's running my life. That's what generates all that self-centered fear and makes it impossible for me to live by a code of love and tolerance. Impossible. So if I know that my problem is bodily and mentally different, that alcoholism, it says on page 30 in the big book, I must accept to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic, that is the first step in recovery. That I must accept that I am powerless over this thing and my life is unmanageable. Totally unmanageable as a result of that one influence in my life. I accepted that fact for me. I haven't done anything yet, I just accepted the fact of that. If that's my problem, lack of power, what's my solution? Step two, that a power greater than myself would be necessary for me to be restored to sanity or soundness of mind, that I can have this obsessive thinking about alcohol and drugs removed from me so that I could not start again. It started getting pretty clear to me that this is a simple game plan. Not necessarily easy, but very simple. So I knew what my problem was, I knew what my solution was, and knowing that, I'll go get high. So I better do step three. Luckily, it's the very next step, man. I better make it I better make a decision to do something about this information. I better make a decision to try and get what they say could be possible for me in step two to happen in my life. All I did in step two was come to believe that this could happen, that I could be restored to sanity or soundness of mind. So I embarked upon a plan of action in step four, as outlined in the big book, with a lot of the guys that are in this room. Man, there's one, there's one, there's one. We did all this stuff together, you know. We've done it together over and over and over again. We did a thorough inventory. Resentment, fear, sex, four columns. No screwing around, man. Black and white, there it is. No as Earl sees it anymore, man. Right like it said out of the book, and I got 4 through 9 laying in black and white right in front of me. My whole action plan. I know what I got to do. I go to the steps to discover how to go about it and what order, and I just do it. I don't have to like it. I don't have to think it's a good idea. I just do it. I did it. Promises started coming true. And then I got left, I mean, as if that's not enough, man. As if that's not enough, 1 through 9, to make me say, this is the best deal I have ever found in my life. This beats the biggest buzz I ever got out there. They threw 10, 11, and 12 on top, just for good measure. They said, you think that's cool? Check this three out, man. These will keep you in the game. These will keep you in the game. Because you got three relationships in your life, Earl. You got God, you got yourself, and you got others. And you got to get right with all of them, and you got to do it in the right order. So we're going to give them to you, 10, 11, and 12. 10 is, keep your side of the street clean, Earl. Take care of your business. Keep your side of the street clean. And continue to take personal inventory. And when you are wrong, Earl, promptly admit it. I hate that word. But they knew who they were talking to, man. They knew they would have to tell guys like me promptly. They know what I'll do with that. Yeah, I'll admit it. Next lifetime, I'll admit that. Next time. 11 is my relationship with God, and I seek through prayer and meditation, examples of it given to me in the book, to improve my conscious contact. Conscious, like I'm awake now, you know? I'm here. There's an awakening occurring. I'm growing. I'm evolving as a human being. You know, and I'll seek through prayer and meditation to improve that conscious contact, praying for the only things I ever have to pray for again in my life, knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. I don't pray for her or the Benz or the house or the cash anymore. You know why? Because I used to pray for that stuff and get it. Sell my ass way short. And I don't want to do that anymore. I just don't want to do it anymore. My best thinking, left to my own devices, I cause problems. You know? I don't want to do that anymore. I want to get the whole show, man. I want it all. Right? How unusual for an alcoholic or a drug addict, man. I want it all. And who's always getting in the way is me. 12, having had a spiritual awakening is the result of doing these steps. That was the whole point. To have step two come true. To have the obsession of my mind relieved. To not be a slave to this deal anymore. To not have to fight going back and maybe having just one again. To get rid of the idea for once and for all, right? That the drink or the drug will not solve the problem at hand. It won't do it for a guy like me. That the minute my lips kiss that pipe, I activate my phenomenon of craving, my allergic reaction, and I don't have anything to say about it anymore. I've lost the power to choose. The game's up. That'll be the last choice I'll make. Until God intervenes in my life one more time, if he does. I mean, I may ask God sometime to say, God, do this for me, and God says yes. And I'll say, God, how about this? God says yes. And I say, God, how about get me sober again? And God says no. God sometimes says no. I've been given the power of choice back. I've been restored to sanity. And it says in the big book on one page, you get your sanity back. You get restored to sanity. It tells you, you've been restored to sanity. If you've done what's outlined in this book, you've been restored to sanity. The obsession of drink and use has been removed. The next page, you get your will back. And it suggests what the right and proper use of that will is. And for me, it's to just give it all back to God. I've got enough lessons in my life to say, me doing it just screws it up. I'm giving it back to God. So I got 10, 11, and 12. I got 10 is me, 11 is God, and 12 is you. 12, having had a spiritual awakening, be of service, man. Carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Because the only person an alcoholic's really going to listen to is another alcoholic. The only person a dope fiend's going to listen to is another dope fiend. Because we come from here. It's a question of experience. And if you say to me, Earl, I think you need to stop drinking and using, I say, yeah, okay, how? You say, well, I read this book. I say, time out. I got no interest in what you've got to say. I haven't read a book. What's your experience, man? Have you been in my seat? Have you dealt with these cravings? Have you dealt with the madness of this thing like I have? No? Then get out of my face, man. I come in a room like this and sit down. There's a lot of guys in this room that I walk up to and say, man, the heat's up. And I know they know what I'm talking about. This is where I got to come, and this is where I got to stay. And I got to carry the message here. And I can't give away something I don't have, so I got to do the work. I got to go in that book. I got to get the message. So when some poor son of a bitch with tombstones in his eyes comes walking in that room and says, I'm going to use. It's a done deal. It's just a question of when. I ain't found any yet, you know? That's the only reason. He says, because I don't know how to stay sober. Do you? I can look that guy right in the eye and say, yep. I know how, and if you'd like me to show you, I'd be glad to. Talk about purpose, a way of life, for a guy like me, impossible, man. Where it's at right now is I'm 10 years sober, I'll be 11 in November. I'm having a wonderful life, man. My life is wonderful. Don't applaud me for staying sober. I'm having a wonderful time, man. My life is a gas. I came down here Thursday, I hung out with friends, I relaxed. Relax, it's like a foreign word to me, you know? But I've done it. I've been having a wonderful time. My life is wonderful. All my outside shit's all kicking again, man. It's looking great. I got a company, and I'm making money, and I got a nice place to live, and I do what I want. I mean, I just do whatever I want. You know what I mean? I'm having a great time out there. You want to know something, though? It's nothing. It's nothing compared to what's happened to me on the inside. Accepting to my innermost self that I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic, and then I've done the footwork in here, and I've had a spiritual awakening as the result, the only purpose of doing these steps. And my life is completely different. I'm loving and being loved. I'm doing the thing I can't do. I got a lot of love in my life. I got friends beyond belief. I don't have a blood family. They're all gone. But I got a new family now, man, and it's better than anything I've ever known because I'm bound to these people by a spiritual path, not by blood. Blood is something that happens, man. A spiritual path is something that you walk together. And we've been walking it with a lot of people in these rooms for a long time. And it's an incredibly rewarding experience. I mean, to get to a place where you're a self-centered, lying, cheating, thieving dog, to get to the place in your life where there are actually moments where you wish peace on earth and goodwill towards your fellow man is an amazing process. I didn't do it. This has got absolutely nothing to do with Earl. And that's the beauty of it. It's got nothing to do with me. What it's got to do with is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles that are set down therein. That anybody who's willing to walk in here, get a grip on those things, and get out of the way and let this deal happen is going to benefit from the process. So if you're new and you're out there and you're thinking, this all sounds nice, but it's a little complicated, here it is in six words, man. Trust God. Clean house. Help others. Only three relationships you're ever going to have. Trust God. Clean house, help others, be of service. It will change your experience of being alive. I mean, and if you're new, you can't have faith in this. How are you going to have faith in this if you have no experience of it whatsoever? How are you going to do that? So you got to make a conscious decision to trust that we're not all lying. This isn't just a room full of people lying, trying to suck you in and take your money. That's not what happens around here, man. what this is about. You make a conscious decision to trust, and you step into these rooms, and you say, I don't know where to take the next step. And there's a guy a little further down the path that says, my experience is when I stepped over there, things went pretty well. You say, okay. And you make a conscious decision to trust, and you step over there. You get your leg blown off, talk to somebody else, right? And you keep moving, man. You've taken worse shots than that out there, or you wouldn't be in here, you know? And you take the next step and the next step and the next step. And what you end up with is you end up being able to look back in your own life, and you have the experience of your own life getting better. That's yours. That's your experience, and you're going to have faith in that. So stay long enough to get the faith that this thing will work for you. Stay long enough to be able to enjoy a weekend like this with your fellows. You know what I mean? I mean, there's a lot of real remarkable people walking around in these rooms, and I've had the good fortune to meet a lot of them. Peace.